So yeah, nothing wrong with asking for support. We need support. But when we're clinging to fame, it becomes a little more insidious, and we're not always that aware of it. And the same thing with infamy. This is a difficult topic. Just use myself as an example. In the course of setting up Mindfulness Northwest and everything getting rolling, I made various mistakes in communication, mostly. And I ended up ruffling a few feathers in the Seattle area, mostly. And there were, and probably still are, people who think that I'm no good, and that Mindfulness Northwest is an aggressive, competitive organization taking away their rightful mindfulness students. And I do feel badly about this, I really do. And for a time, I really suffered a lot and tried like really hard to figure out how to avoid this infamy, how to fix it. And yet, there seemed to be no fixing it, and I knew that I had a deep and, I believe, wholesome desire to offer mindfulness as fully as I know how in the region in which I live. So I did my best to be inclusive and listen and go to the meetings when I was invited and to accommodate others as best I could. But I learned and remember that actually I can't accommodate everyone else's belief in how things should be. And also be true to my heart and true to my intentions. And that some of the infamy that is projected on me and projected on you may be justified, and some of it may be the confusion and suffering of others. It's really pretty much impossible to completely put those into two piles. They're mixed up. So we accept infamy as best we can, humbly, always willing to listen and learn. But here's where we really need our equanimity practice. Very important. And our self-kindness and compassion practice. And our compassion for others practice, because there's a lot of suffering usually when infamy arises. So we listen humbly, we see what we can learn. And we get really curious because someone thinks you're doing it wrong and no good. Could mean any number of things. Should result. It could mean you shouldn't change a thing. It could mean you are being absolutely pig-headed and you should back down and do it a different way. Or shouldn't have even been in that area at all. Or it could mean a little bit of both. This is a great area to have wise friends to advise you, because I think on our own we can't really untangle infamy when it arises. It helps to have wise friends with a broad perspective to help us look at multiple sides and facets of any situation. And we should watch out when we're working with infamy that we don't just ask our friends to reinforce our righteousness, because we do that too, right? I need your support. I'm right here, right? You know? There's a certain kind of support, I suppose, but it's a little limited. Maybe you need that provisionally until you're ready to see a broader view. Pretty much we're all right and we're all wrong all the time. So fame and infamy are pretty challenging. The third pair, praise and blame, are kind of like the same dynamic, except not writ so large. Praise and blame we can study in a more moment by moment, day by day way. Is the action that I am drawn to take, is this action that I am moved to take rooted in seeking praise or avoiding blame? Or is it more deeply rooted in my intentions, my good understanding, and my love for the world? Am I willing to take this action regardless of whether there's praise or blame or nothing comes back? We don't like the nothing part either. There's a great compassion training slogan that helps with this particular case. This is a slogan I've worked with a lot. Don't expect applause. Don't expect applause. This is good for parents. You don't get much applause from the kids. Teachers, therapists, just about anyone who ever had bosses, you know, supervisors, just about anyone who ever interacts with anyone. I guess that's all of us. You do something really helpful, you put some energy into it, you deliver this something, and then it's like, hey, wait a minute, where's my thank you? I worked hard on this. So you might see if that moment arises for you. Next time it does, maybe this phrase will pop in, you can just study. You know, I'm not saying how you should act, but just reflect on this and see what shifts, if it does. Don't expect applause. Okay, right. This can really help. The last pair are, in a way, the hardest. Joy and sorrow. Joy and sorrow. Here's where things get really close to the bone. And it may be some imagination is needed here. And remember again that these Buddhist teachings are really kind of high bar teachings, ultimate freedom teachings. There's nothing wrong with using these part way and becoming a little happier. 20%, why not? But the idea here is we can unhook our well-being from joy and sorrow. Which is a little funny because we just spent the week running around telling you to tell yourself, may I be happy. So what's this? It's like a trick at the end, you know? So I was talking to somebody and reflecting on this, and it might be that happy doesn't have quite the right valence for us in English. The sort of feeling and freedom that loving kindness is pointing to is maybe a little different than what we think of usually as happy. Maybe it's more like, may I be deeply content, accepting. May I be okay. Do you know that the word okay has transmitted itself to every major language in the world? Yeah, okay. So it's a deep thought, okay. Doesn't sound like much. Where does it even come from? Like, why letter O and K and write it out like that? Maybe the etymology is lost in the depths of time. So not being blown by the worldly winds of joy and sorrow is a deep unhooking of our okayness from things being to our liking in big ways and in small ways. And so it's kind of a deep unhooking of our internal state and the external conditions, which is difficult because we have very strong assumptions and beliefs and how tightly hooked together what happens to us and how we feel are and should be. Sorry, it's buzzing again. Well, we take it for granted, you know. Of course I'm upset. Think that any better?
I think it is, yeah.
Okay, we're going to switch. Oh. Yeah, it's better for a moment. So we take it like for granted, you know. Of course I'm upset, you know. This bad thing happened to me. My friend, my loved one is angry with me. Of course I'm obsessively thinking about that all the time. Of course I'm angry. I was inappropriately excluded. I'm oppressed. And this is not to say that oppression is not real. So this gets very subtle, you know, it's hard to talk about. without diminishing something that's really important at the same time. So it's maybe more than a practical teaching as much as planting a seed. That maybe we can hold those linkages and our powerful assumptions about how the way it goes for us a lot more lightly, with a lot more curiosity. Can I hold this tragedy, this sorrow, in a big, big space, you know? Or yeah, it's painful, but not so destabilizing or debilitating. Not exactly awful in that way that at first I assumed it to be. Because it's amazing, actually, what human beings can bear when they have to. And the thing is, we have to, all the time. This is the world that we are in, and it is full of unbearable sorrow. And yet we can bear it. And still, in some fundamental way, be okay. Be happy, even. So it's easy to see the challenge and the depth of that with sorrows, but joys are a little harder, maybe. But joys, too, can be destabilizing, or maybe inherently are destabilizing if taken a certain way, a certain kind of clinging, a certain light. Yes! You know? So I guess what I'm trying to say is we can practice not being so worked up or excited in either direction by the joys and sorrows of the world, because life happens, you know? It's okay. Joyful things happen, wonderful. And that's fine. I'm okay. I'm standing on the ground. So here's our equanimity practice again. Terrible things happen, that is difficult. These teachings are not saying that difficulties are no longer difficulties. That is really hard. And that's fine. That's how it is. I'm okay. I'm on the ground. So I hope that makes some kind of sense and we haven't confused you too much with "May I be happy?" And we really do hope that. May you be happy. Or at least, may you be deeply okay. So, the chapter of the Buddhist text we were referring to mostly is called the Visuddhimagga, 5th century Sri Lankan text, ends the chapter on these four practices with like a sort of a summary statement, an exhortation about how to do all this. So I want to share that with you. I'm actually just going to read it without comment, and invite us all to just listen and not worry too much about the grasping of the intellect. Maybe something will just land in our bones from what this great sage wrote all those years ago about these liberating practices of loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. So, Buddhaghosa wrote, "For the great being's minds retain their balance by giving preference to being's welfare, by dislike of being's suffering, by desire for the various successes achieved by beings to last, and by impartiality towards all beings. When a practitioner has understood thus that the special efficacy of each of the four divine abodes resides in having beauty as the highest thing, she should understand how they bring to perfection all the good states. This begins with giving." This begins with giving. "For the great being's minds retain their balance by giving preference..." Oops, sorry, I repeated a paragraph, copy-paste error. Okay, This begins with giving. In order to avoid doing harm to beings, they undertake this giving by undertaking the precepts of virtue. They practice renunciation for the purpose of perfecting their virtue. They cleanse their understanding for the purpose of non-confusion about what is good and what is bad for beings. They constantly arouse energy, having beings' welfare and happiness at heart. When they have acquired heroic fortitude through supreme energy, they become patient with the beings' many kinds of faults. They do not deceive when they promise, I shall give this to you, I shall do this for you. They are unshakably resolute upon beings' welfare and happiness. Through unshakable loving kindness, they place the others first before themselves. And through equanimity, they expect no reward. Thus, having fulfilled the 10 perfections, these divine abidings then perfect all the good states, including the 10 powers, the 4 kinds of fearlessness, the 6 kinds of knowledge, and the 18 states of the enlightened ones. This is how the great beings bring perfection. This is how the great beings bring to perfection all the good states, beginning with giving. I'm going to break my vow a little bit and just reread one little section. This seems like good advice out of there. Oh, never mind. I'm going to stick to my vow. Otherwise, we'll get tangled up for an hour. You can read it later. See what you can untangle. But it did emphasize giving. I noticed that much. And lots of energy and a deep understanding. And giving with equanimity, without reward. So I hope that's happened this week. Whatever we remembered or didn't remember, whatever we did or didn't do, however well we think we did or didn't do in the many practices and following the schedule and the guidelines and so on. I think we each had the retreat we needed. I have a lot of faith in that, and learned what we needed to learn, even if it's not apparent to our intellect. You know, these various teachings are pointers towards something that really is quite deep and profound, but also, in a way, deeply simple. Be yourself. Truly be yourself. Be a complete human being. Inhabit your amazing capacity to express more love and understanding and compassion and patience and flexibility and equanimity than probably your conscious mind believes possible. And that's okay. This is a bigger deal than what your conscious mind quite believes. We'll give the last word to Hamlet. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.